Okay, welcome to the eighth installment of Cognitive Science 200, spring 2007, on the temporal dynamics of learning. Today, I'm very happy to have our Director of Education and Outreach, or I should say Co-Director of Education and Outreach, and the PI of the Rutgers subcontract, and she has, I'll have to say this is a woman who needs no introduction because I haven't done my homework. Paula Talal, who started Scientific Learning Corporation and has developed methods by which you can use neuroplasticity results to actually affect children's reading scores. And this is an example of a situation that we hope to replicate many times in our center. So take it away, Paula.
Okay, I should also say that I'm the co-founder of the Center for Molecular and Behavioral Neuroscience at Rutgers, a center that we started over 20 years ago. I was actually recruited from UCSD together with my partner Ian Kreese to start this center, and it was really a unique idea at the time, and that was to integrate the field of neuroscience from the molecular, cellular level all the way up to the behavioral, cognitive level. Doesn't sound like such a novel idea today, so I guess we were somewhat successful in doing that. But I think that this center, the Temporal Dynamics of Learning Center, is a culmination, I think you'll see today for me, or a beginning for me, at another level of my life's work, trying to understand what the neurobiological basis of language development and disorders are. And the title of my talk is Improving Language and Literacy is a Matter of Time. Now, there's lots of different kinds of research over the last 30 years that have contributed to the results that I'll be sharing with you today and the model that I'll be sharing with you today. And they're quite diverse, and there are a lot of people have been involved. And I'm not going to read all of their names, but the work stems from initial studies in the behavioral linguistic domain. And that's fine with me. Is it okay with everyone?
Yeah.
Okay. The behavioral linguistic domain includes animal studies, an animal model that we developed, particularly in collaboration with Holly Fitch and Mike Merznick. And we've included gene linkage studies and intervention studies. And over the years, with lots of great collaborators, a variety of imaging studies incorporating initially structural imaging here in San Diego with Terry Jernigan. I believe it was the first ever structural imaging study of a child, much less a child with a particular impairment. PET studies, early PET studies, MEG studies, and more recently fMRI studies, particularly in collaboration with John Gabrielli's lab at Stanford and now at MIT. Language has been considered to be uniquely human, and as such, it's been difficult to apply the majority of what we'd call systems neuroscience techniques to the study of human language. Now, traditionally, as you know, what we know about the neural basis of language has been derived primarily from observing the effects of specific lesions on specific areas of the brain. And when you have a lesion in this area, of course, it's known as Broca's aphasia. In this much larger area here, Wernicke's aphasia with its component behavioral characteristics. More recently, with the advent of functional neuroimaging technologies, we've been able to revolutionize our ability to study brain activation patterns generated by specific types of tasks, particularly language tasks. But despite these advances, it remains really difficult to connect the study of the cytoarchitectural regions involved in language with the study of neural circuitry. So we know what the regions, the where of language may be, but we know very, very little about the neural circuitry. And I would contend that maybe the holy grail, ultimately, for cognitive neuroscience is to have a very high-level function, and language, of course, is the most complex and probably highest-level function, culminating in evolution, connected down into what most neuroscientists spend their life working on. And currently, most of the techniques and most of the issues of interest to neuroscientists really just, it's a bridge too far to think about how it relates directly to language. Our research is focused on understanding the neurobiological basis of language development and disorders. And we began our research program with the observation that many children with specific developmental language impairments, called SLI, and reading deficits, have particular difficulty at the phonological or speech level of language. And I just want you to look at some of these little kids. I mean, these children, a lot of people have not had the opportunity to work with children with language impairments, and they really don't know exactly what to expect. But these children are completely normal, healthy, happy, they're beautiful. They, on the whole, are pretty well behaved. And everyone was kind of surprised when they just didn't really learn to talk at or near the expected age. And in general, children like these are impaired. What was that for? What happened, Gary? Hold on. I'm going to just go back. I know. Yeah, okay. I don't know why that did that. Anyway, they're impaired in language many times 2 or 3 years behind in language. And so it's also important to remember, though, that children learn language at, there's a lot of individual difference at the rate at which children learn language. And certainly if you have a 7 or 8 or a 9 year old child who's even 2 years or 3 years behind, they're still talking. A lot of people say, are these children mute? What do they sound like? They're still talking. They're just talking very much like a younger child. And a lot of research is focused on, are they just delayed? Is there anything really different about their language development? And that's a whole different topic. But there's a lot of research primarily at the linguistic level. Okay. Computer's not working, Gary. Darn. Not going forward. So, hold on, sorry.
Hmm, that's interesting. Bonk, bonk.
Page up. Oh, it crashed on us, huh?
I don't know. I've never seen that happen before.
Just close, maybe close it and start over.
Close it and start over?
Just close. So, anyway, I said that the research that we've done really pinpointed or focused on the phonological or speech level. Now, that was really interesting in terms of a general model, because it added something quite important to this long-term life goal I've had of connecting up what most of my colleagues in neuroscience do at the circuit level up to language, because it suggested that if we looked at speech rather than language per se, language being the rules and the grammar, if we looked at speech and considered speech a perception and production system, then that really allows us to think of the sensory motor systems in the brain, and there's a ton of neuroscience that's focused on sensory motor systems. So that was a big step in just conceptualizing this model. And in order to study the phonological deficits in more detail, we began to focus on the speech signal itself, but considering it a sensory motor system, taking that perspective. The early studies that we had led us to discover that language-impaired children have particular difficulty in both perceiving and producing brief, rapidly successive stimuli, importantly in a very specific time window, which I'm going to call the tens of millisecond time range. Now, most of the research I'll show you, and indeed most of the research that I talk about a great deal in the papers that I gave you and whatever, has focused on the perceptual side, but it's important to remember that we did a lot of very detailed studies, we and others, that show that very similar kinds of problems emerge if you just look at the speech production of these children as well and think of that as a motor, sensory motor system, and particularly in this tens of millisecond time window. Children with language impairments, this earliest work showed, have difficulty sequencing two rapidly presented stimuli at rapid rates. Okay, so this is the kind of the classic experiment that we can begin with. It's published in 1973 in the journal Nature. It was my first paper. It's published in Nature. And a lot of people have asked me, how in the world did you get a paper in Nature as an early graduate student? And the honest answer is that they were short. And I thought it would be easier to write a short paper than a long paper. So I didn't even know it was a big deal to get a paper in Nature. I just thought it would be a lot easier to write a short paper. And that's how I got my first paper in Nature. Okay. Oop, it just did it again. So let's see what's happening here. Andrea, we might need your computer, I'm not sure. All right, we'll just see what happens. Okay, so here's this experiment. This is a really important experiment to understand. What I was interested in is whether or not the precursors to being able to analyze the complex acoustic signal that might be involved in speech were all in order for these children. And so just a basic clinical differential diagnosis would say you begin by, you know, making sure a child can pass a hearing test, because if they're deaf or hard of hearing, we wouldn't be surprised if they had a language problem, right? Then you do an IQ test and you make sure they can move their oral musculature around, and any one of these, if there's a problem in any one of these areas, then that would explain the language problem. So I went a step further and I said, we did all of that and all of that was normal. But what happens to the sound as it goes from the ear up into the brain? And how do you test that that's all okay? Because speech is a really complex signal. So I thought I would be able to just go to my friendly research literature as a graduate student and come up with a nice model of central auditory processing. And one of the biggest surprises of my life then, and even to a great extent still now, is that we know so little, really, about the details of what happens in the auditory system, let's say in comparison to the visual system. You can think of like the big model for vision, you know, with a million different pieces, and then you might look for one for audition, and it's really sparse. Okay, so the auditory system has been studied a great deal less, and so I had to go to the animal literature, and it was probably one of the best things that ever happened to me, because I didn't know as a graduate student I wasn't supposed to be thinking about what happens in the animal brain as it relates to speech and language. That's kind of verboten to many linguists and many people even today, but it seemed logical to me to go to the animal literature and get some idea of what we knew about how sound moved from the ears through the nervous system. And basically, based on that model, I developed a series of simple tasks that would look at the integrity of certain stages of auditory processing. You know, can you detect that a signal occurs at different frequencies, intensities, and durations? That's kind of a hearing test. Can you detect that you've heard two versus one? Because if you haven't heard two things, then you don't have much to process, right? If I go beep, beep, okay? Or if I go beep, you know, hearing the difference between two and one is a timing cue. If I just go beep and then put a little gap in it, beep, at a certain point you'll hear two. And when it's too fast, you'll just still hear one. Okay? So you need two in the system to be able to do anything interesting in any sensory system. Why do you need two? Because let's say I go beep, is that high or low? Relative to what? So you need a second signal, okay? So hearing a second signal is a temporal cue, and that's the first stage in the nervous system really early on that says that temporal processing is going to be important. Once you've heard two, okay, the next thing you have to do is say, are they same or different? And then the different features of the auditory system come in, which are frequency, high and low, are they high or low, loudness, you know, is it soft or loud? That's called amplitude. And time, is it long or short? And these are all trade-offs with each other. So I developed a series of little tasks for kids to do. They were hierarchical. They only changed one variable at a time, and I found that kids who had language problems as compared to controls, and these were about 6 to 8 year old kids to start with, they were fine in their ability to hear and detect sound at the peripheral level. Same amount of amplitude needed for them to hear it. They could actually do two versus one pretty well. They could do same and different discriminations of frequency pretty much the same as other kids, with one exception. They needed much more time between the two signals you're asking them to discriminate between than control children. So here's this experiment, which has, as I said, been replicated many, many times. That's important for you to understand because we use it a lot in the studies that we're going to talk about. We have two sounds, okay? One's higher than the other. Ugh. Okay? One was low, one was high. Kids are taught to just press the bottom button for the low sound, the top button for the high sound. We never label them verbally. They're just operantly conditioned, just as if they were a monkey or a rat, right? Press that button when you hear the low sound, And then once they've got that, press the other button when you hear the other sound. Now we're going to put two together, tell me the order in which you heard them. Okay, and you can see these kids are completely fine at doing that. At this duration, about a half a second, 500 milliseconds, these kids are great. No problem. They can remember it as long as anybody else. Once they've got it in their brain, just making them sound longer, beep, beep, they can remember them. It's not a problem holding on to them. But when you begin to make them, when you begin to present them with shorter interstimulus intervals, and the interstimulus interval is just the gap of silence between the end of one sound and the beginning of another. Let's listen to it. You can see that the typical children with no language problems really doesn't faze them much. They're still almost at perfect performance, whereas these children just fall apart, just absolutely fall apart. And then if you make them even faster still, the typical children continue to be over 85% correct, but these children with language impairments, again, can't do them. Okay? Now, what's interesting is that this yellow range is the range necessary for picking up the acoustic changes that tell our brain what speech sound we've heard, what phoneme we've heard. And this blue-green region is the amount of time that is important for syllable discrimination. So the duration of a whole syllable versus the duration of a single phoneme. So that's the first thing that led me to begin to be interested in what might be going at the level of speech. But that pulled in a nice piece of this model. So here we are with circuit level mechanisms. Every time I do that, it does weird things. Okay, no, just click it, it goes back. All right, maybe I should use a pointer instead of moving this cursor around. Maybe that's the problem. Is this a pointer? Is that a pointer?
It's going to turn off the, if you push the wrong button now, you're going to turn off the projector.
Okay, so which one is, who has a pointer? Anybody? No? All right. All right, I will point. All right, so that just adds something here to temporal dynamics, specifically in this tens of millisecond range, which I got from the previous slide. Is that clear? So we've got circuit level, temporal dynamics, and the tens of milliseconds, sensory motor system, speech, articulation, and perception, and language.
Excuse me.
Thank you very much. Okay, so our data then supports an experience-dependent developmental model in which temporal dynamics, specifically in the tens of millisecond range, serves as the conduit between some of the most basic circuit-level mechanisms and many of the fundamental components of language. Okay, all of a sudden this thing starts to really explode, and it's really exciting because I kept going to neuroscience talks because I am a co-director of a neuroscience center, but I wasn't trained in basic neuroscience. But over 20 years, I learned a few things. And one of the things I kept hearing was something that seems like this magic number, 30, 40 milliseconds. There are so many basic mechanisms that are really critically dependent on temporal integration in this 20 to 40 millisecond range. One of them is spike timing dependent neuroplasticity, gamma oscillations, synchronous activity, and synaptic integration. And there's whole literatures on each of these. But what was really interesting is that they all specifically are in what I would call this tens of millisecond time range. And they are some of the most important circuit level mechanisms that have been studied. So I hypothesized that perhaps we could begin to really make a connection up into language if we began to focus our research attention on collaborations that would really think about these different mechanisms as they might relate to specifically temporal dynamics, and then from temporal dynamics also move up into the level of language. Now, language, language is a big deal. We talked about speech, but spoken language has many different characteristics that also are highly dependent on processing in the tens of millisecond time window. And I'll show you some of the data behind this, but some of the most interesting is that phonological representations of specific types really are completely based on processing in this tens of millisecond time window. Segmentation of speech into words. There's some beautiful studies done in infants and also more recently in children using imaging that show that the ability to even segment the ongoing speech stream into words is highly dependent on the same time window and that it's a statistical exercise for the brain, that the brain is actually pulling out consistencies within the ongoing speech stream very, very quickly, and grouping and segmenting information that occurs successively in rapid succession. So that's a really interesting study. One of the more recent ones is published by Morella DiPreto at UCLA, which is very, very interesting, and shows in using fMRI that it's related directly back into proficiency in this tens of millisecond time window. Grammatical morphology, the ability to actually hear the weak and brief sounds inside of sentences and words that tell us important grammatical information. Also, in many cases, someone out there did a really good study looking at various grammatical morphemes that were either weak and brief and of low phonetic substance in sentence context, or those same grammatical morphemes, other grammatical morphemes, I should say, that are developed at the same time in developmentally, that do not require weak, brief processing. Now, stress on a signal, duration of a signal, or whatever. So we can think of something like S as in plurals, ED as in past tense, in general, are very brief, occur very, very quickly. They're usually unstressed in its use in compulsory sentences. Whereas ING, which is developed at the same time, is not. And so we can begin to separate things out that way. Instead of thinking about them entirely linguistically, let's think about them acoustically. And it comes out to be very interesting indeed that those grammatical morphemes that are acoustically unstressed, are acoustically brief and weak in the sentence, are the ones that language-impaired kids have trouble with. And then even social interaction, I added that. I was so excited when I first heard about Javier's research with Ruby, and to find that even social interaction, our ability to really engage with another being, even if it's a robot, is entirely dependent on precise timing in this time window to determine what the feedback loop is in the brain. So when they got the timing wrong, kids would come up and play with this little robot a little bit and then move away. But when they got Ruby, which can look at the child's facial expressions and respond back by raising its eyebrows and doing other cute things, when they got that timing exactly right between when the child smiled or did something and Ruby responded with either a beep or a sound or whatever or a facial expression, bang, it was magic, as Javier said. Yeah. Well, it's probably an interaction. There's, of course, a whole theory about the motor theory of speech perception, about it's been pulled into the mirror neuron story. It's probably, we know that there's going to be a limit on speech production, although some of us can talk a lot faster than others. my favorite example was Liz Bates, who I think was the most incredible. Had the most incredible verbal skills of anyone I ever was fortunate enough to meet. But, you know, some people talk a lot faster. It's not surprising that she also was very fluent in Italian. But, you know, so there is a limit, and there's a lot of differences. But that's a really interesting question, and I think it may be both.
Basically, yeah. I'm wondering whether the time frames of speech, basically you're trying to pack in as much communicative information as possible,
right,
within the limits of that bottom level of mechanisms
which
were available,
right,
or whether some of those mechanisms may actually have
evolved.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, that's a really interesting question that we should think about more as we go on. Okay, for speech, tens of milliseconds can actually change the meaning of a word. These waveforms are actually identical, except we've used a computer to insert a 100 millisecond gap of silence here, and yet because of that 100 milliseconds we hear completely different words.
Say. Spay.
Okay, since these are computer generated, you can see that we hear something completely different different when you have that 100 milliseconds of silence. This is called voice onset time. It's a gap of silence in the signal. And you can see that there's a, when you have a gap, we perceive that we closed our vocal tract, and therefore we must have been saying a stop consonant, whether it existed or not. Tens of milliseconds can also determine which syllable we hear. Many speech sounds or phonemes differ only by brief spectral frequency and or temporal changes, specifically in the tens of millisecond time window. And these two have been used quite a lot in our research and other people's research. In fact, in the whole field of speech science, there are six sounds that have been used more than anything else: ba, da, ga, pa, ta, and ka, because they can be completely controlled and they have to do with basic changes in what are called the distinctive features in the motor system, but also in the acoustic features of frequency and time. So ba differs from da only because in this case these frequency envelopes of energy rise here and here, but fall here and there. Now these are called formant transitions. It's just a jargon term, but if you hear about it when you're reading, you should know that these are called formants. And what we see here is that in the second and third formant, the only difference between ba and da occurs in about 40 milliseconds. The whole rest of the word, the whole rest of the syllable is longer and louder, and probably is acting as a masker, in terms of, if you think about auditory masking, on our ability to perceive these weak, brief, rapidly successive signals. So we say that these are weak, they're brief, and they're followed in rapid succession by longer, stronger elements in obligatory context within these syllables. Okay. But not all speech sounds contain rapid spectral changes. They do in context, as I said to the students earlier. But we can pull out speech sounds and say them all by themselves, like eh or ah. I can control how long that is as long as I want. I can make it short, eh, eh. I can make it long, eh, ah. And what's characteristic is that I don't move my vocal musculature as I'm producing those, no matter how long I keep them, right? But with ba and da, I have very little control. I have plenty of control if I want to extend the vowel. If I say to say ba and da more slowly, I'll say ba or da, but that doesn't really help me. I can very little control over the onset part of the signal. That's the part that is a plosive or explosive part of the signal, and it's weak and followed rapidly in succession. It's very brief. But because of these kinds of sounds that are steady state versus those that are more complex and have rapid transients, it sets up a perfect experiment. And given the original study with language-impaired kids that was in Nature that showed that they needed more time between stimuli, led us to hypothesize that their problems were not specifically linguistic or linguistic-specific, but they were really acoustic, temporal-specific. And so in order to ask that question, we asked language-impaired kids to listen to two sounds and again learn to press one button for one sound, the other button for another sound on a two alternative force choice psychophysical method. And in one case, they were steady state. In the other case, they had these rapid transients. So we used ba-da and we used eh-ah. And the results were really striking. What we found was that language learning impaired kids had no difficulty just changing into speech, because as long as they were steady state vowels, they all were able to learn the tasks perfectly well. We could control everything. These are both 250 milliseconds in duration, these signals. But here we have no transition, and here we have a 40 millisecond duration transition. And only 2 of 12 children in this study were able to even learn correctly to press the bottom button for the ba and the top button for the da. Excuse me. So it was a pretty profound, amazing result at the time. I thought I was going to graduate. This was part of my thesis. I was thrilled with this result. I went back to my thesis advisor, Malcolm Piercy, and I was like, time to go, you know. I've got these great results. I've got the non-linguistic. I've got this hypothesis that it translates into the linguistic. It kind of did this experiment, shows that it really does relate to bas and das and not as, and that's because of the timing. And he goes, wait a minute. He said, there's a lot of difference between vowels and consonants that may not be acoustic. And you haven't proven it to me yet, because he was much more on the linguistic side, that this is something acoustic. So I'm like, what am I going to have to do to prove it to this guy, you know? And about that time, this whole room opens up where they're going to put in this first computer. I'm old, okay? I just had my 60th birthday 2 weeks ago. So this is a long time ago. And in comes this huge machine, and it's the first speech synthesizing computer. And it was shipped to Mark Haggard, who was a real one of the all-time greats in speech science. None of us knew exactly what to do with this thing, but I got this idea that what I would have to do to prove to my thesis advisor, Malcolm Piercy, that the problem really was temporal dynamic rather than something linguistic, was to use the computer to artificially extend out the duration over which these critical formant transitions were occurring. And if I was right, this should improve the performance of children with language impairments. And if I was wrong, then it should make no difference. So we didn't really know what we were doing, but we thought, let's just kind of double this and see what happens if we can make this, we didn't even know what it would sound like. But anyway, we used this computer and we synthesized two sets of syllables. The first two you heard, the ba and da with 40 millisecond duration transitions. And then we had these, which we call the extended duration transitions. I'll let you hear them. Ready?
Da. Da.
Okay. They were clearly ba's and da's. We did a whole study with trained linguistic transcribers. They were just as good at these as they were at the others, or just as bad at these as they were at the other, which depends on how well you listen to synthetic speech. But the question was, what happens to kids with language impairments? Would it help them at all? Because again, we weren't asking were they ba's and da's or anything. We just said, can you separate these sounds acoustically on these two buttons? And the results, again, were absolutely dramatic. These were the original results. Remember, only two kids could learn this task with ba's and da's with 40 millisecond duration transitions. And everyone did fine with the vowels. And when we gave them the stimuli with longer duration transitions, whop, they were fine. We, of course, did the experiment again, counterbalancing everything, and great result. And by that time, I did understand what nature and science meant, and I tried to submit this paper, which actually I think is much more profound and important. And this one got rejected because no one believed it. They just said, I just don't believe that, you know. They couldn't give me any reason experimentally or anything. They just didn't like the result. So it got published in Neuropsychologia. actually, it took us about 30 years from the time that I published this paper to actually recognizing that this would be a really profound way to intercede at a much broader level for children with language impairments. And so one of the things that we do in what's called Fast for Word is to use this basic idea of extending in time and amplitude enhancing the rapid, fast components inside the syllable that we have little control over in our articulation. But the computer has total control over them. So we developed a computer algorithm that could, what I call seek and destroy, the fast changing acoustic parts of speech, sounds in speech, and make them longer and louder. We'll talk about that later. At this point, I should disclose that I'm giving basically a talk about all of the science that has been funded over 30 years period of time by by the NIH and now by the NSF. But as part of that, towards the end of the talk, I will talk about the development of training programs called Fast for Word, which were also funded as basic science originally, but now are commercially available products. And as I was a co-founder of the company, Scientific Learning Corporation, that now markets those products to public schools, you need to understand that to the extent to which I have a conflict of interest in presenting those data. Interesting.
Where is the extent?
Look it up on the internet. It tells you everything.
Really big or
very big. okay. Nothing about my life is private. If you want to know, you can actually find that out on the internet. Over two-thirds of children with language learning impairments have also met the diagnostic criteria for dyslexia. This is really interesting. Now, to most of us sitting in this room today, that probably is not a surprising statement. But again, there are two really big controversial areas in my field. One of them is whether or not the phonological problems that characterize children with language impairments are related to more basic, what's called domain general deficits in sensory, perceptual, or motor systems. And the other was the extent to which reading problems, dyslexia, actually derive from more basic spoken language deficits. Okay, they're both connected by phonology. Everybody understands that. But a lot of people say, look, I study kids, I work with kids with dyslexia all the time. They talk fine. And my response to that is, how many of you have ever tested them using as rigorous standardized tests of language as you use of reading? And the answer in the field of dyslexia, believe it or not, is virtually nobody does that kind of study. So it's getting to be now that people are starting to test language, but this is one of the few studies that did test both the language and the reading abilities in great detail using standardized clinical and research tests and showed that 2/3 of children who met the criteria for language impairment, SLI, also meet the clinical and research criteria for dyslexia. That's a lot higher than most people think. And interestingly, there's a highly significant correlation between the reading problems as most defined by the phonological awareness hypothesis and the rapid auditory processing abilities of children. So what's a good test? If you want to know whether someone's dyslexic, you could give them a 5-hour battery of reading tests at any age, and you'd have to worry about their age and various other things. Or you could give them one reading test. Actually, it's not even a reading test. You could give them one task, okay? And it's called nonsense word reading, all right? You could actually ask them just to produce a series of nonsense words. If I say Miss Blickett, can you say Miss Blickett back to me? Okay, so that's really, really a good sensitive measure, even of someone who's dyslexic, which says the problem is not visual, okay? If I ask you to read a non-word, it's really much more sensitive than if I asked you to read a series of words, because you could have memorized that series of words just through hard work, right? But if you can read non-words, words you've never seen before, that are pronounceable, could have been a word, but just don't happen to be in our language, right? That means you have actually broken the code for reading. You are phonologically aware. You know what sounds go with what letters and what letters go with what sounds, and you can pronounce a series of letters into a word, okay, like Blickett. Not a word, but if I read it, B-L-I-K-I-T, I could pronounce it perfectly well as Blickett, okay? But if you don't know the rules, then you can't do that. You might say blanket, okay, because that's the closest it is to anything you've ever seen, and you just guess. Or you might even say boyfriend, because it starts with a B, okay, because that's all you know. So that it's a very sensitive measure of dyslexia is just to ask individuals of any age to read nonsense words, so we did. We rank ordered children. This time, this was a study of dyslexics. We did not select kids as language impaired. We selected them as reading impaired. Met the criteria that everyone would agree on for reading impaired, meaning you have a normal IQ, normal opportunity to learn to read, and you're at least a standard deviation, or in our case, a standard deviation and a half behind the norm on standardized reading measures. So if you rank order these kids according to just how many errors they made on a test of non-word reading, and then you did that little beep-bop test that I let you listen to at the different rates of presentation, you get almost a perfect correlation. It's a very high correlation. The more errors you, the more time you need to integrate two brief, rapidly successive acoustic tones, basically, the more errors you make in reading non-words, suggesting these kind of go together. Can't say they're causal, but they certainly seem to ride along together. A whole other series of studies that I don't have any time to talk about today were very interesting. I spent 10 years of my life and the life of my lab and all my colleagues doing a family genetic study, because language learning impairments, including both spoken and written language, tend to run in families. But only about 40% of the kids who have language learning impairments have any other member of the family who've ever had them. So that's not the only way you get there. But it's a very interesting result that we found that we were able to link a gene, a level on the chromosome 13q21 for SLI. Now what's really interesting about this, and I just don't have time to talk about it, is that in completely separate studies on autism, this is the same area that has been identified. And autistic children, or individuals with autism, have two main characteristics. Okay, one of them is a language problem, and the other is a social interactive problem. And what happens, they separated out the children with autism in the family genetic studies that had a more serious language component. And those are the ones that really, really are loaded on this particular chromosome. So it suggests that at least for the language components of autism, there's some potential overlap genetically. And what goes on to create the differences between these populations is something that's still very much involved in genetic studies. We use the results of this study probably more profitably than just coming up with a couple of papers saying, look at this region, and isn't it interesting that it's related to autism. My colleague April Benesich, who's also involved in the Temporal Dynamics of Learning Center, was very persuasive to the families that were involved in our family genetic study, who were coming in and giving their time and giving, you know, letting their kids get tested. They got tested, all the kids' siblings got tested, the grandparents, if they're alive and willing, got tested, the nieces, the nephews, the uncles. This is a really tough business to get into these family genetic studies. Don't do it. But it just takes an incredible amount of effort to find these large multi-generational families with several members affected. But we did that, and what we really got interested in was seeing whether or not we could just convince them, since they were already a large multi-generational study, what difference would it make to them if they had one more baby for us, right? Because that would be a really cool study, right? So they complied, many of them complied, and April's very persuasive, right? And it took many years. Do not try to get tenure doing this. This is really, really tough work, because it takes years to get the results I'm going to show you, and they're just so powerful. What was needed, there's so much argument in the field about whether or not the temporal auditory processing problems, if they even exist, which of course I think is pretty straightforward now. There's hundreds of papers that show that they do. Are they causal? Do they cause the phonological problem? Are they just secondary to it? Are they just kind of the result of not learning to read? Maybe you get to be worse at this stuff because you didn't learn to read. What was really needed was what's called a prospective longitudinal study, where you begin with really young infants, well before they've ever learned to talk or learned to read, for heaven's sakes, well before anyone has any suspicion that there's anything potentially wrong with these children. And you want to study babies and test them repeatedly at brief intervals, so you get to track the things you're interested in. What you want to know is what, if anything, that you've tracked predicts who ends up having good language development and who ends up having poor language development, and then subsequently who ends up being a good reader and who doesn't. Now, this would be a great study to do just with any number of kids, right? But your hit rate of getting language impaired kids would be about 10%, which is not bad, but that's about the incidence, and under 10% is the incidence in the regular population. So if you could just get these families to have a couple of extra babies, then your hit rate will probably go way up, because our family genetic study showed that if you did have a baby, if you did have two or more individuals who had a language learning problem, your chances of having another baby is about 50-50 that ends up carrying this problem. So we had these very cooperative parents, and we trained. But then we had another problem. Not only did we have to get them to have a baby, but we had to figure out how to get babies to press buttons, right, in the order in which they heard them. And we realized that's not going to happen. So we developed a different procedure. And so what April and I developed together was what's called this head turn procedure, which is used quite a lot in the clinical world to just test hearing or something with kids. And what you do here is that this little reward box is actually developed here by as part of another, I think it was a McDonald grant that we had, that Liz Bates was the PI, and this was developed at San Diego State, actually. But this box, which is the reinforcer box, has six different little panels, and inside these little boxes are animated toys, mechanical toys, and that keeps the baby interested. They don't know what's going to come up, and when they do something right, they turn their head to tell you what they think happened, and when they're right, one of these lights up and claps his hand or barks or plays, and the kids love it. You know, it's just really fun. I'll show you how this works, okay? So this baby is listening to sounds, and it's been trained operantly that something interesting is going to happen to her left when there are two tones that are different. So she's going to listen to two tones that are the same, and then all of a sudden they'll change, and then if she hears the difference, she's going to turn her head, all right? And when she's right, one of those little animated toys is going to light up, and if she's wrong, nothing happens, and she goes back to watching what's going on up front. Now up here, you can see what's going on in front of the baby, so you'll watch that. There's a little puppet show going on in front of the baby to get the attention forward, because you have to keep the baby's head forward so they're not just staring at the box the whole time waiting for something to happen. So this is quite complicated. The mom has to wear headsets because we don't want her cueing the baby when she hears a change. So she's listening to music and can't hear the changes at all. And then there's catch trials that you'll see a light up in the film, and that means that half the time when the light lights up there is going to be a change, half the time there is no change. And then you compare when the baby turned their head to a change versus a non-change trial. So it's really complicated. It's all computer controlled though, and the amazing thing is you can see these babies love it. They do it really well. Okay, so it takes a lot of patience, and I must say the lab at Rutgers is probably one of the world experts at this kind of research, and they have just gotten incredible data and just keeps getting better, but I'll show you some of the data. Okay, so the experiment is you start with a 500 millisecond interstimulus interval, because that's a level that we had found in our original studies with kids was no problem for children with language impairment. Remember that? Listening to the two sounds, 500 milliseconds, piece of cake, right? And then once the baby learns the task, it's a stepwise, discriminant procedure, so the computer automatically begins to decrement the duration of the silent gap, the ISI, between the end of the first beep and the beginning of the second one. And when the baby gets two right in a row, the next one will be even shorter, and when they get one wrong, the next one will be longer. And you're looking for six crossover points between getting it right and getting it wrong. And then if the baby really starts getting a bunch wrong, you give them one with 500 milliseconds again just to make sure the baby hasn't just tuned out. Okay? And they have to get two of those right in a row to say, yeah, I still remember the task and I'm still listening. I just can't hear it when it's that fast. So there's a lot of controls built into this. And what we had hypothesized was that children who were in family history positive for language impairment would require more time if this was really related or even potentially causal to the language impairment, and that children who were controls would be able to all do this in this, you know, in this important 20 millisecond, 20, 40 millisecond, tens of millisecond time range. And we were partially right and partially wrong, but the results were even much more interesting than we originally thought, or we had originally predicted. What we see here is that there's a highly significant correlation between how much time an infant needed at 6 months of age, or 7.5 months of age on average, in this rapid auditory processing variable, and that same child's language comprehension percentile when they're 3 years old. So this is prospective, longitudinal, predictive outcome, which is very powerful. It's, again, the holy grail of developmental research is to be able to predict from early variables what's going to impact cognitive and particularly linguistic development, what's going to predict it. So what we found that we didn't expect was that this was equally strong for the control children as well as for the family history children. Whereas there are many more family history children who are in this frankly impaired range, the relationship between how much time you needed, in other words, how fast you were processing rapidly incoming information, was equally important for all children developing language, suggesting that what we have been studying that relates to language impairments in the past, or what we thought related to language impairment, actually relates much more broadly to all language development. That the individual differences in how rapid and proficient our brains are at processing rapidly successive information is at some level driving our ability to pull out the statistical probabilities and other aspects that are important, that are necessary for our language, okay? Rapid auditory processing at 6 months actually predicts developmental language delay. Now, the previous slide was not talking about delay. It was just talking about relationship across the whole domain of individual differences. If we want to look at what clinically would be considered an actual delay in language, we use the verbal reasoning scale on the Stanford Binet IQ test and found that rapid auditory processing thresholds at 6 months, together with male gender, classified 91.4% of all three-year-olds who scored in the impaired range on the Stanford Binet. And I think that was more than a Stanford, more than a standard deviation. And there were no significant correlations between rapid auditory processing and nonverbal outcomes. That's a very important thing to show. So many studies, I think it was one of like the pitfalls of doing kind of this kind of developmental research looking at impairments versus not. So many studies have shown that the impaired group is different from the non-impaired group on anything you give them, on everything you give them. And that to me shows you nothing other than there's something generally going on that you don't know what it is. So the real crux of these kinds of studies is to show that the children are fine, equally good on many variables, and specifically impaired on one or more variables. So this is a very specific finding saying that this rapid auditory processing is yoked to information processing that relates to language, but not to other nonverbal performance. Yes?
On the slide that you had before, mm-hmm. with the graph, so these are, the red and blue are only have to do with their family history. And
yes.
Whether they actually developed like a learning impairment.
That's right. So that's a very good point. The red and blue, at the time that this study was done, these children were 6 months old to begin with, and we had no idea who was going to end up, if any, of these kids language learning impaired. And that's a very good point. So the red just relates to their family history, not to anything to do with the child. Okay, because when the baby's in there, they're all looking the same, and they're all happy and whatever. Some have brothers and sisters or maybe parents who've had a language or a reading problem, and others don't have anyone in their family. But other than that, they all learn the task. There was no difference in their ability to learn this task. Okay, the difference is how much time they needed between the two stimuli. So you were able to identify and develop an actual individual threshold for each baby. So what I'm really saying is that every one of us in this room have a different threshold for how much time we need. And unfortunately, as we get older, I'll show you some data at the end, and these guys over here are working on that part of the problem. We get older, we start to slow down. And that has also impacts on our speech and language as well as memory. So these individual differences in temporal dynamics and processing, particularly in the auditory modality, have a big impact on future language development, no matter whether you did or didn't have a family history. Okay? And just like height and weight, we're beginning to think that one variable that really differentiates people is just how fast their brain is processing information. Now, there may be also very important social and environmental factors that impact how much stimulation you get, how many words you get, that would help to set up these statistical probabilities. So we don't think that the whole thing's about rapid auditory processing. But your rapid auditory processing really impacts what you do with the information you get. And then how much information you actually get also interacts with this whole issue. Because there's some incredible studies that have shown that children from lower socioeconomic families have a whopping 30 million word deficit by the time they enter school in comparison to children from higher socioeconomic studies. This is just the boringest research you can ever imagine. They did an actual word count of every word a child was exposed to. And this is Hart and Risley's very famous research. There's a whopping 30 million word deficit just because of social class in terms of how much is spoken to the child. Secondly, there's a big difference in what kinds of affect are spoken to the child. The emotional content of words is different. Let me just finish this thought and then I'll get to you. So if you look at, of all the words that are spoken to children from high socioeconomic classes not only get many more words spoken to them in conversational form, they get very many more positive words. What a cutie you are. Look at you. That's right. And children from low socioeconomic classes get a lot more negative words. No, don't do it. Stop it. You're bad. So, and that's very well established research. It's very well represented and well worked out. They're really good psychologists. But the implications of this by the time a child enters school is that, number one, I haven't had as many inputs as my brain might need to set up sufficient statistical probabilities for learning language. And secondly, I've learned that language is punitive, not pleasurable. Okay, so should I listen to it? Shouldn't I listen to it? And this has a lot of implications, I think, for the kinds of work that we're doing in the center. Gary?
You mean 30 million tokens? Because there are 30 million types.
30 million word deficit. They have been spoken.
What do you mean by that?
All right, so if I'm talking to you.
30 million words fewer that they've heard?
Yes.
I mean, because there aren't 30 million words in English.
No, no, 30 million words fewer that they've heard.
Tokens,
yes. Okay. So if I'm talking to you, and I'm a higher socioeconomic parent, and I'll say, look at this. Isn't this a beautiful coloring book? Do you have colors? Look at all your colors. This one's red. This one's yellow. Can you pick up the... Good for you. That's terrific. And if I'm a mom, maybe from a lower socioeconomic class, I might say, why don't you color? No. Don't scribble. No. Pick the red one. That's ugly.
And I'm sorry, this deficit is by what age?
Hart and Risley. Okay.
By what age?
Entering school, 5 years old.
5 years old. Mm-hmm.
Huge
so that's
impact.
6 million words a year.
Yeah. Okay. Or so. Okay.
Sorry, is that also a contrast between what the parents say to the kids and what the caregivers say while the parents are out working trying to get enough money to feed their families?
Could be. Yes. Yeah. I mean, that's been looked at in terms of daycare versus at home with mom. Actually, daycare's better many times, depending on socioeconomic class. Also depends on what kind of caretaker you might be having with the child and how they use language. I mean, there's a lot of research that has just shown that different cultures and different socioeconomic classes use language for different things, you know, and they express things differently. And one is not necessarily bad. I mean, it's bad to have a negative affect to your child. It really affects their self-esteem, and it gives them less of an enjoyment. But there is contradictory evidence. There's certain, certain Indians, I'm not sure if I've got this right, who don't say a word to their child until they're like a year old because they just don't think it matters. They carry them on their back, that's it, no worries. They grow up learning language fine. So there's a lot of issues involved here, but these are very interesting studies if we think about the brain as a device that is extracting information and probabilities from a system for its learning, an experience-dependent learner, and if you've got very different amounts of information to be extracted, it's going to have an impact. Okay,
how many words can you say in a second?
I don't know. Who knows? Anyone know how many words you say in a second? Depends on who you are and how fast you can talk.
I mean, I'm just, you know, this is like 1,200 words a minute or something like that. I figured out.
Work it out. Let's not
30 million by, you know, 5 years and go out to
an auction. You know, you're a farm kid.
What?
You do a lot of cattle auctions as a kid, and then you go, your dad's taking.
Yeah, well, that's it.
Okay, this is April Benesich, our esteemed colleague, recording the electrophysiological activity, event-related potentials from infants. I don't have to explain this to you how it works, right? But you can actually put these cute little caps on, which can record the brain waves of these infants. It doesn't hurt. They allow it. Mom, again, is got earphones on. They're usually doing either a passive task or in some kind just listening to a story. And in the background, they might be hearing beep, 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 beep. Beep, 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 beep. Okay, and they want to know, does the brain respond when you hear that change? Okay. Same task as we used in the head turn procedure, but this time the baby doesn't have to do anything. Okay. So the question there is this an easier way to get to younger babies and also potentially to get inside what's going on in the nervous system? And can it teach us something new? And this is just a great result, just recently published. It says in press here, but it is published now. Electrophysiological differences using a mismatch response, MMR, to rapid tone sequences are observed in infants with a family history of language learning impairment. And what we see here is that there are actually no significant differences between the control infants and the family history positive infants when you use the tone sequences that have 300 millisecond interstimulus interval. This is the most beautiful result. I'm so excited by this. So you see there's no difference between these. But when you go down to 70 milliseconds, then you see that there's a very significant difference in the response between the controls and the language-impaired children, sorry, the children from families with language impairments. These kids are not language-impaired at the moment. And interestingly, it also shows that infants with a language impairment family history show significantly reduced MMRs at 70 milliseconds, and the significant group differences at 70 milliseconds occur primarily, where is this, guys? Left Broca's area, okay? So this is a completely non-linguistic task. The babies are listening to beep beeps, okay? And just their brains are either detecting or not detecting when it goes from beep beep, beep beep, beep beep, beep beep, beep beep, okay? Beep beep, beep beep, beep beep. And the question is, does the brain pick that up? And the only difference here is in one case it will go something like beep beep, beep beep, beep beep, beep beep, in which case they're fine. No difference in the physiology, no difference on the head turn. But when you just merely change that temporal component of how fast the stimuli are presented into this tens of millisecond time window, you get this big difference, and that difference is occurring primarily in the left frontal region, which is associated in our minds with Broca's area. Temporal dynamic processing, specifically in the tens of milliseconds, has been shown to activate left hemisphere-specific brain regions traditionally associated with language. Here's another really cool study. Now, what time do I have to stop at? 4:30? I'm sorry, at 4:30, I'm still late. Okay, this is a very cool study just being published. It was initially presented in 2000 at PNAS with adults. We've just finished a study that's in press with children with language impairments showing primarily the same result. Cool stimulus. Big argument out there, as I said, you know, is there linguistic specific left hemisphere processing, or is that related to something about the signal that's acoustic? Our hypothesis is it's related to the acoustics and particularly to the rate of dynamic change in the signal. Big argument on the other side, hundreds of papers investigating this issue, okay? Most of the papers investigating this issue use a verbal stimulus, and their control stimulus is a nonverbal stimulus that does not incorporate rapid transients, okay? Usually music or environmental sounds or something along those lines. These stimuli are very clever. They were developed by Pascal Baylin, and he said, let's take a stimulus that on the surface looks like what you would see, four formats, rapid onsets and offsets, at the onset of the onset offset of a syllable, like a CVC, consonant, vowel, consonant, syllable. This could have sounded just like a speech sound or a word like cat, but the relationship of these formats to each other make it sound pretty much like a tone because they don't represent any particular speech sound in our language. So what he did is he made these stimuli and then he merely extended the duration. This was based on my original work, the idea of doing this. Let's just make this longer, short steady state and a longer offset. So you see what he did? It's all computer generated. And what happens is they sound pretty much alike and you couldn't use them to discriminate because you don't have a word for them. And so what he did was he superimposed a high sound and a low sound as a fundamental, both on this one and on that one. So there's these stimuli with a high or a low fundamental, and these stimuli with a high or low fundamental. And all he's going to ask the subject to do is listen to a series of these and press a button every time you hear one that sounds high. So I'm going to let you hear this, okay? Wow, that's really loud. Sorry. Okay, those are the ones with the rapid onsets. These are the slow onsets. Okay, so you can kind of hear it's bleh, but we never tell the subject anything about the onsets are off. So if we just say raise your, press a button or raise your thumb or whatever the task is whenever you hear a high one. Okay? So that goes along going, and you're just raising your thumb. And it's pretty fast, and you have to listen to it and raise your thumb, right? And you go from blocks that have rapid onsets to slow onsets, and you don't really, when you're doing the task, you don't really hear too much of a difference. The question is, does the brain care? Does it matter to the metabolic activity whether they were rapid onsets or slow onsets? And so you subtract out the brain activity when they are a slow onset from the brain activity when it was a rapid onset, okay? And what you see, whoops, get back, Loretta.
My dongle.
Okay, what you see here is that the left hemisphere's specific response, there is a left hemisphere specific response to the rapid non-speech analogs for temporal spectral acoustic stimuli. Thank you. So if you got fast minus slow here, you see, interestingly, you end up with activation, high, very specific activation in the left frontal region. This is the area primarily associated, Andrea, with working memory, 4610, okay, right above Broca's area, which is generally 44, 45, okay?
What's the 12, 16, 20?
Slices.
Oh.
Okay. Okay. Interestingly, doing the same task, the dyslexic's performance is exactly the same. They have no trouble raising their thumb or pressing a button when they hear a high one, but their brains do not selectively differentiate between the ones that were fast and slow onsets. Really interesting. Yeah, they are doing it, and that's how they can do it behaviorally, but it sure isn't where it's supposed to be, right?
But wait, this, oh, I thought the contrast was, but the contrast is fast.
Versus slow.
Slow, right?
Right.
Not the
high-low.
High-low, right?
But what they're doing consciously is high-low.
They are reporting a difference between fast and slow. It's just in a weird spot.
Right. And so there's no activation in the region of interest here in the dyslexics. Okay?
But
so
it doesn't make that other spot uninteresting.
Pardon? It
doesn't make that other spot uninteresting.
Oh, no. They're following up on that. But this was really a proof of concept that dyslexics, first of all, that this rapid auditory processing is left hemisphere specific, and that what's going on in speech potentially is not specific to speech in the left hemisphere, but specific at least at one level to the acoustic temporal spectral configuration that characterizes ongoing speech. And dyslexics just don't do it that way. Okay, whatever's going on for them, they're not using this area of their brain for that purpose.
I think it should be called ROAI.
What is
ROAI? Region of author's interest.
Yeah, right. Well, could be. In this study, it was not, because we were looking for if there was any activation. So it was the region that the experiment showed you was of interest, right? Okay, so here's something for Dan and Andrea and those of you who are interested. In order for this to actually become useful to us in terms of the original question of ending up being able to link circuit level mechanisms up to language, we needed to create an animal model. And rats don't talk. One of the best funded, most well-known scientists of our in the area of dyslexia research, who's done wonderful research, is Bennett and Sally Shaywitz, a couple at, where are they? Cornell. Are they at Cornell? Yale. Okay. Bennett starts his talks at most big dyslexia meetings with a picture of a rat holding a book. And the caption says, "Rats squeak, humans speak." And his second slide says, "There is nothing we'll ever learn from animal research that will inform us about the neurobiology of language." And that's like, close the book, off we go. So, and that is current, all right? So, anyway, this study's kind of anathema to them. They're really big researchers in the area, very well known and very well respected. They just don't think that language has anything to do with these other subsystems. Well, you know, animals don't talk. I agree with him. They don't read. But they sure process sound. They have sensory and motor systems. And so that's what the big advantage of this whole model is thinking of these deficits or these differences, or not even deficits or differences, thinking of language development at some level as being an elaborated analysis of a sensory motor system. So we were interested in this whole hemispheric specialization question, right? What's the left hemisphere for? And everyone says, well, you know, that's another really uniquely human thing. Humans are the only ones who are really specialized. Rats may like their right or their left side, but it's not, you know, it's random. And we did a study, Holly Fitch is the primary author of this, to see whether or not that was true. So we had to rig up this little device to get the animals to listen to sounds dichotically, putting two sounds in the ears at once. And we also had to develop stimuli that were in the range of hearing for rats. This is all a little interesting. And they had to listen to tones. And so they stuck their head in this plastic tube to get a water reward. And when their ears were stuck up into the right places, so they were right inside the headsets, they had a little diode that sort of says, okay, you can present the stimulus. When you presented the stimulus, they had to either go or no go in terms of whether it was their target. So we trained them to a target. And I don't think I have the results here. I don't think that's what I ended up bringing for this particular presentation. No. But anyway, the results were that the rats were left had a right ear advantage or left hemisphere specialization. They did better when the target was in their right ear than when it was in their left ear. Really cool, which is pretty cool, right? So that showed that, in fact, if you ask the right question, rats do indeed have many similar characteristics, and at least we could look at the biological origins of hemispheric specialization using this kind of a method. Anyway, we went on to, as is one of my graduate student, Matt Clark, went up to work with Holly Fitch and Glenn Rosen at UConn, and they developed this new method for looking very, very quickly at this issue and developing thresholds for animals. And what they're doing is an acoustic startle reflex reduction paradigm. I'm not going to go into the details. Andrea and whoever else is interested, and Dan and those whole networks that are interested in animal research would want to look at much more detail at this. Basically, make a long story short, they gave lesions to these rats that were similar to the ectopic and microgeric lesions that Al Galliberta has found in his work looking at the brains of dyslexics. Okay. And they were able to create these kinds of lesions. There's a lot of research on this, and that's an animal model for dyslexia. And we looked at those animals, and we asked whether or not the animals that had these ectopic and microgeric lesions had any difference in their responses to two-tone stimuli with relatively long interstimulus intervals versus short. And the answer was really cool, that there's no difference between the sham-operated and lesioned rats on the longer duration stimuli, but they're really whoppingly different on the shorter duration stimuli. So there's an attenuated response, and the lesion rats were significantly different from the shams in detecting short, but not longer, two-tone duration stimuli. And that's been published and replicated many times.
That looks like they're better.
This is a startle reduction paradigm. Yes. And then there's also been this genetic research that's been allowed by this method, because there's a gene that's been isolated for dyslexia that's been created in a mouse or a rat, and it's called DYX, dyslexia 1C1 gene knockdown in a rat model of dyslexia. They were able to study these rats with this particular knockdown of the dyslexia gene, and found that these same, again, they found a startle reduction in the rats, that had this gene knockout, which is unbelievably cool, because again, it's showing you can use these kinds of paradigms really to get down into the molecular and cellular levels. And that's
the
only reason I brought it in.
Rats have universal grammar.
Pardon?
It's amazing that rats have universal grammar.
Universal grammar, absolutely. So now I'm going to run really late. Do you guys know about neuroplasticity research, electrophysiological recording, mapping in the brain? Okay, Mike Mersnick's kind of work. Have you read that? Okay, let's make this really fast. All right. it's been shown that the cortical area responding to complex sounds is much smaller in naive rats than in trained rats. So you take rats, you give them whoop, 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 whoop versus whoop, 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 okay? And then you train them, all right, by increasing the duration between when these weeps and whoops occur. So they go whoop, 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 whoop. And if you get that right versus whoop, 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 and the animal has to make a two alternative force choice. If you get that right, then you get trained ultimately so you can actually track with great precision, much, much faster. Whoop, 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 that kind of thing. So they train them using the rat's own performance, trial by trial, to either speed up or slow down. And they find that the cortical responses evoked by periodic trains of FM sweeps were less in number and persistent in the naive rats than in the trained rats. So not only do you improve behavior, but and you improve the area of the brain that's activated. Okay, what happened? Stop looking. Don't stop. Okay.
You shouldn't go near any machinery.
There you go. It's activated, okay? Yeah. I've got this aura, right? And it goes everywhere. Right? All right. And also it starts following very, very beautifully. So that was pretty exciting. Again, very, very basic animal research. You can train the brain to change its neural map and the extent of which to which an area or cells in that area are able to be interested in these rapid onsets and offsets. You can improve the precision in post-stimulus time histograms. And that led us to the final part of my talk, okay? What an incredible thing that Mike Merznick and his colleagues and many, many other electrophysiologists have done, because their work was with rats and monkeys, primarily monkeys, and they showed for the first time that the brain was really plastic throughout the lifetime, well beyond the critical period. And I heard Mike give a talk at a meeting in Santa Fe, the Santa Fe Institute. Oh, I don't know, it must have been in 1992. And I was giving a talk at the same meeting. It was organized by Bela Ulish, which I'm sure all of you know about. And he called it Neuroplasticity and Aging, Is There Reason for Hope? Okay. And he brought people, all sorts of people from very different backgrounds, vision researchers, computational modelers, physiologists, and I was the token human behavior person there. And I realized from looking at Mike's work, and Mike realized from looking at my work, that we were both talking about something that sounded so different, but in fact was quite basically similar in the area of temporal dynamics. Because in his work, I haven't had a time to show you, but that work showed that you can speed up the rate of perception, and it was the speeding up and paying attention to that that was actually driving the neuroplasticity. So we decided we had to do a study together. And the study was to find out whether or not we could use the neuroplasticity-based training approach that he had developed in animals to translate that into an intervention that might, in fact, be able to speed up the rate of rapid auditory processing in slow kids. Okay, it's like literally make a slow kid into a quicker kid. I mean, who wouldn't want that, right? So, we start this model. If we want to intervene for children who have language and reading problems, based on our theory that it's related at a very fundamental way to rapid auditory processing, rather than just hammering away at reading, which obviously is very, very problematic for these children. I'm not saying it doesn't help, but it sure is hard and isn't really, you know, taking care of the problem. What if the problem resides at some basic level and that we can begin with that level and build from there? So the first thing you'd want to do in this goals for intervention would be to speed up the rate of rapid auditory processing. Then we would want to systematically refine these children's sensory motor systems using, again, neuroplasticity-based approaches. Then we would want to explicitly enhance their speech perception and production. Okay? That would help us then develop and strengthen their language development, explicitly training them with grammatical rules that they're having trouble with, and then directly begin to improve reading. But this would be the order that we would want to go. And in Mike and Bill Jenkins and many other people's work at the physiological level, they had identified what they called the scientific learning principles, derived from neuroplasticity-based training studies with animals. And this was that stimuli needed to be frequent and intense. They needed to be individually adaptive, driving from easy to harder trials. They needed to sustain attention if you just presented these kinds of stimuli but didn't require the animal to sustain attention and actually perform a task. It didn't drive neuroplasticity at the physiological level. And they needed timely rewards. And by timely, they meant really timely. From the point of the response to the reward needed to be timed in highly specific ways. Okay? And that's because of neurotransmitter release, and you know, we don't have time to go into the whole thing, but that is really important. The question is, could we instantiate those into something that children could do? Because you can get animals to sit there and listen to these really boring stimuli or sounds or do tasks, you know, because they're hungry or thirsty because you made them, but you can't do that to kids. And we're thinking, what can we do that kids would do over and over again and really boring, you know, listen over and over again, make responses? We came up very quickly with video games, right? So we created a series of neural plasticity-based training exercises disguised as video games, okay? Aimed at doing all these things, okay? So first thing we want to do is improve rapid auditory processing, right? So what we want to do, we want to take the first task I showed you, which is called the Talal repetition test, the beep-boop task, right, and reverse engineer it. Instead of making it an assessment, let's make it a training. Take the computer, get it to find whatever amount of time the child needs between two sounds, and then as a child gets it right, they get two right in a row, the next one's faster. If they get one wrong, it's slower. Very, very slowly adapting to see whether you could actually drive the nervous system to change, to become more rapid in its responses. We didn't want to use pure tones because then we'd have to train every single frequency. We wanted to use sweep tones because they're more like what happens in speech, like the ba and the da, the upward and the downward sweep. And we wanted to cover the entire range of frequencies for speech because that's what the animal study shows we're going to have to do. So we developed this little task called circus sequence. See if I can make it happen. All right. Okay. You'd have to press this one and then that one. And if you got it right, she's going to go up. You're going to get a point. And when you get her up to the top, you're going to get a whole animation. Okay. That's how this works. And you keep going with lots of different animations and different circus characters and stuff like that. And they have to be frequent and intense. They actually play this about 20 minutes a day, 5 days a week, together with 7 other exercises, all aimed at different levels of language, to see if we can drive neuroplasticity. As the training progresses, the rate of presentation increases based on each child's trial-by-trial response. So this is highly individually adaptive. It doesn't work if it's not. So let's see if I can make this happen. Creature, and they start the next. So they have to get it up to the top, get a little video, they know what they're doing, and they can do this for long periods of time. Even kids with attention deficit disorders, who everyone said would never do this stuff, they love this stuff, and they will pay tremendous amount of attention, and you build it over time. In addition to a lot of different things, you're building the amount of attention and focus that the child needs, and that builds in over time as they get more and more right. So one of the things that happens when children have to take tests, SATs, PSATs, statewide achievement tests, is some kids who have learning disabilities, they get accommodations, right? What's an accommodation? You get more time to take the test. So then you ask the teachers, but about how much time can these kids focus? And they said, oh, you could count that on two hands, right? So what is giving them more time going to do? If you can't focus for more than 6 minutes, how is it going to help you to spend 2 hours instead of 1 hour taking a test that you can't even focus 6 minutes on? So we're really focused now on improving the attentional time, duration of attention and focus, as well as rapid auditory processing. Okay, so that's how that worked. And then we want to sharpen sensory motor systems. We want to build cognitive strengths in general, because beyond rapid auditory processing, the research that we've done, which I haven't been able to present, and research the whole field has done, has shown that there are mental building blocks for all good learning. And those, of course, include memory and attention, processing, precision and rate, and sequencing abilities, to name just a few. So we want to build all of those individually and jointly within these exercises. And so there's a tremendous amount of work that went into every exercise, every stimulus, trying to think about all these cognitive skills in addition to language that we're building. One, enhanced speech, and this is where this acoustically modified speech comes back. Remember I talked to you about the extending the formant transitions? We created an algorithm that will take anything you put into it, so you can do a whole series of speech and language training exercises, but begin it with this acoustic modification that seeks any acoustic change in the 3 to 30 hertz range and makes that segment of the signal louder and longer. Okay, so let me let you hear what it sounds like.
Touch the green circle.
That's normal. You put that into the algorithm and it comes out sounding like this.
Touch the green circle.
Okay. Well, when we first heard this, we were just about to start our first study because we sent all the commands that we wanted to be included in the therapy or the intervention to Mike's lab. Mike and Bill created this algorithm and put it together, got it back to us in typical fashion for them about 24 hours before the kids showed up for the study. And when we first listened to this, we were devastated. We said, there's no way the kids are going to listen to this stuff. Well, the interesting thing over all these years is very few people who have difficulties say that sounds bad to them. They just listen to it and they begin. And the computer automatically moves back towards normal speech, individually adapting, trial by trial again, back to normal speech. So the goal is to go and now explicitly train every rule of English grammar. And this is what we're now doing for our English language training programs as well, that we think will be highly beneficial in countries that don't have all the phonemes that we have and are having difficulty hearing these different sounds, as we were talking about earlier, to provide these training programs also, not only for kids with language impairments, but for individuals who, because they didn't get exposed to all the sounds of English when they were young, are having a lot of difficulty capturing them, to bring them back into the way that physiologically we learn them, we believe, to begin with. So it's a very exciting kind of new venture and direction for us. So then, as I said, we made a whole series of programs. This one is one focused on working memory. It's similar to what was called the token test.
Put the white square beside the red circle. Touch the green circle.
Okay, now this starts off pretty easy, and it gets unbelievably hard. So there's no level that you can get to that someone can't do. So it could say, after touching the green square, take the circle that's below the yellow square and move it between the blue square and the white circle. And you get to hear it once. Okay, so it can go on, and so it covers all the different ranges. And interestingly, this is something that decrements as we get older as well, our ability to do that. It gets better as we get from child to about 9 years old, and then it's downhill. It gets hard. Okay, so you got the idea. So you can do anything you want. You can develop any kinds of exercises you want. And we've focused on memory, attention, processing, and sequencing within the listening and language domain with explicit training of every rule of English grammar while we're at it. Okay? And that's what it would sound like normally. So we're going to strengthen language development. And then we did an intervention study, and I got to really get done with this. Can I have 5 more minutes or not? Is it too long?
Yeah.
Is everyone okay with that? You have to go? No? Okay. Because it gets exciting.
It used to be 2 hours.
Oh, okay. That would have been helpful. All right. So intervention studies. So it's a great idea to have a great idea, right? It's so fun and exciting. But the question is, does it work? And you have to set it up as an experiment. It has to be a well-controlled experiment. And frankly, the truth was I absolutely did not believe this would work. I thought there was no way in the world this would work, but we better get started. And once we figured out what was wrong, we could figure it out, we could fix it up and stuff like that. My idea was that eventually we would have to develop some sort of a hearing aid-like thing, a prosthesis that was going to change speech in ongoing time. And Mike said, no, I really think we can, you know, basically train them out of this problem. And so I said, let's give it a try. You know, we'll do both. We'll create the algorithm that would be needed to slow down and expand the speech, but then we'll try to end up getting them to be able to process all different levels of speech and language, and then subsequently reading as well has been involved now, but using regular speech. Okay? So the first thing we did was we selected a group of children who were quite impaired in language. This is their age in years, right? And this is their standard nonverbal IQ and their language comprehension. So you can see they're about 7.5 years old on average. Their IQ is normal, well within the normal range. There's no difference between the red group and the blue group because they're matched. And there's no difference in their language comprehension with each other, but they're significantly below where they should be, okay, in language comprehension. So we have language impaired children, 22 of them were assigned to two groups matched on age, IQ, and the severity of their language impairment. One group, the red group, received intervention with the acoustically enhanced speech and the temporal modification, the circus sequence, okay? The second group received exactly the same intervention, but with natural speech and did not get the circus sequence. They played another computer game that was not temporally driven, okay? But they both received exactly the same amount of speech therapy, the same commands, the same feedback, everything, but one had it with the acoustically enhanced speech, adapting back to normal, and the other just started with natural speech and went through the same intense training program. The question is, does it make a difference? After intervention, which was only in this study, 4 weeks, okay, these are kids who are a year and a half, or standard deviation and a half below their age, after most of them have had intensive speech therapy for years. And after only a month of this intervention, the first question was, could we change their temporal integration threshold? And this was just whoppingly exciting. I mean, I actually did cry when I saw that, because all these years of studying these kids, I just thought they were broken and we'd have to work around it. And this really indicated that we might be able to, at some level, fix the problem, at least the rapid auditory processing problem. Second thing we saw was that speech discrimination improved, language processing improved, and grammatical comprehension improved. And these are big improvements. These are standard Z scores, which are standard deviation equivalents. Now, both groups improved, so the intensity of speech therapy really helped. So that shows that both groups were benefiting, but the blue group benefited less. So anything above zero is a benefit, right? If they got worse, it would be below the line. But these are really, really big changes. And these changes not only changed the whole theoretical understanding of what we were dealing with, it changed my life very significantly, because it was based on these findings and a subsequent study that I insisted we do before we actually publish this, because I knew what was going to happen if it was replicated. That's what led us to develop Scientific Learning Corporation. Because when this got published, the phones just started ringing, please send the CD. And of course, it wasn't that simple. And it's taken us about 10 years to figure out how to really implement this appropriately and get precision of our protocol, get compliance. I mean, all the things you have to do with the medication, plus much more, you have to do with a training program. So it's a long step between getting a good idea, proving it in the lab, and figuring out how to implement it widely for the use of children in clinics and schools around the world. And then we wanted to improve reading as well. And so we wanted to see whether this really did affect reading all by itself. Now, this is absolute proof of a theoretical concept, because the argument was whether language was really underlying reading problems and whether temporal auditory processing was even involved at all. And so this is a group of dyslexic children in Palo Alto. They've been to a very fancy school for a very long time, four dyslexic children with tremendous amount of phonological awareness and phonics training. So they know what they're supposed to do, they just can't do it. Because look at these kids at the beginning of the study on the blue. The blue are the dyslexic kids These are the control kids before training, and the red is the same kids after training. And you can see in real word reading, in non-word decoding, and in passage comprehension, all of these children, despite the very best that money can buy, are still a standard deviation or more below the mean. And this is the same group of children's scores 6 weeks later after doing this program. Now, what's fascinating is we're looking at real word reading, non-word decoding, and passage comprehension of written material. There's not a letter in this version of Fast Forward. So that was really proof of concept to us, and I think to the world to a great extent, that what our theoretical basis was of how one would go about intervening really was effective, much more effective than other kinds of approaches. But everyone wanted to know, but did it change the brain? Now, the phone starts ringing, and now it's scientists, not parents. They want to know, can they do an MRI study, an fMRI study? Does it change the brain? I'm going like, what do you think is going to change their toenails? Of course it changed the brain. Look at their language and reading scores. Where else did that come from, right? But we wanted to see if it changed the brain, and Elise Temple and John Gabrielli got to work, and they did this study in which they looked at fMRI activation while children viewed two letters and just determined whether their names rhymed. So let's say you get a card and that has these two letters, these capital letters, okay? So there's no confusion about orthography. And you say inside your mind, there's no auditory stimulus, you say inside your mind, B, D. Then you determine, do those sound alike? Do they rhyme? And if they do, you press a button. Or you could get these two, B, K. Do those sound alike? No, they don't rhyme. Don't press the button. That's all they had to do. There's no difference in the performance of dyslexics and controls. They hear the sounds, and they can say whether they rhyme. These are older kids. They're like 12, 14 years old. They can do this. But look at the brain activation. There's frontal and temporal parietal activation in the left hemisphere on this task. This is a task we didn't develop. This is the standard task used for dyslexics. Frontal and temporal parietal activation in the controls. But in the dyslexics, they have some frontal, although it's a real mess, and virtually no temporal parietal activation before training. Okay, so this is the signature that's been shown in many different studies now. That is the difference between dyslexics and controls in these two main areas. And the question was, does this intervention that doesn't have any letters in it, and this is the task, does that change this activation after training? And there's a result. Remember, this is the first result. And these are the same children's brains 6 weeks later. So after training, the metabolic brain activity in dyslexics much more closely resembles that of normal readers. They have increased activity in the frontal as well as the temporal parietal region. In fact, it's going to town here, right? Now, there's a lot of other differences, many in the right hemisphere, which are really interesting in terms of compensation. That's still being followed up. But this was the first study that we know of that showed that a behavioral intervention could change the metabolic activity in the brain of an impaired population after a particular training. Subsequently, we've developed a whole series of reading programs. I won't go into them. They're very complete, covering what children from preschool through high school are required to know for their statewide achievement tests. And they scale, and they are individually adaptive, and they build these cognitive skills as well, memory, attention, processing, and sequencing, but they do so within the context of the actual content that children have to know to pass these kinds of statewide achievement tests. And those have been highly popular amongst the schools, who can understand this because it's got letters in it in a way that they had a hard time understanding the original programs. But they basically do the same thing. And they're just fun and cute, and they have to read stories and comprehend them and do all sorts of things. And then there is a randomized controlled trials. There's hundreds of these now on the Scientific Learning website, looking at the differences between students who did participate in Fast Forward, as well as compared to a control group that was initially matched perfectly, but did not get Fast Forward over the same period of time. 73 students identified struggling with phonemic awareness were randomly assigned to one of two groups, matched on the degree of language impairment. Participant group used fast-forward language for an average of only 34 days, while the control group received regular school intervention. Pre- and post-assessment showed that, on average, fast-forward participants made significantly greater gains in language ability than control. So these are the language data. This is Cherry Hill, New Jersey, I've got a couple more slides and we'll be done, but they're getting more exciting, I think. Okay, so we can improve language. The programs were developed initially for language. What about improving reading? That's what we kept hearing. That's what the schools are under the gun for. Kills me, it drives me nuts that they think it's more important to improve reading than improve a child's ability to actually communicate and talk to you. But schools are not in the business of teaching kids to talk. They're in the business of teaching them to read. So if we want to have kids provide programs that are really more useful for kids, if we want schools to do that, we have to kind of speak their language. And so they wanted to know, do these programs, and this again is fast forward language only, actually improve children's ability? And now we're going to take a really tough school district. This is a school district of Philadelphia. It was a failing school district. It was about to be taken over by the state. Look at these lovely reading scores. These are fourth and fifth graders. This is where they should be. And at the beginning of the study, this is where they are. They're not even at third grade level. And the blue group is going to go through regular intervention for struggling students in their school. And the red group is going to get fast forward here in September for 32 days, and it's going to be followed longitudinally to see whether that made a difference to them. Then once they finish fast forward, they go back to their regular classroom and get the same thing these kids are getting. And what's incredibly exciting is not only is there immediate effect, very significant effect, but it keeps on going so that we are closing the gap finally for these children. Now, if we give them additional products, all those cute reading games going from first through fifth level, then we are now doing the study and hopefully this will be even more accelerated. But this is the first example, I think, in a public school with a large number of kids, over, I think, 16 schools participated. And this was given to children in their regular classrooms on the computer, monitored. Okay, and then finally I'm going to talk about something. These guys over here from Posit Science, our sister corporation, who are here working with Scott Makig, are very interested in, and that is what happens at the end of life. As I said several times, unfortunately, even for the best of us, our brains slow down. Okay, that's just a fact of life. One of the main things that happens as we get up to seniors is, I always say, the definition of middle age is when the broad mind and the narrow waist change places. I could say when the fast mind and the narrow waist change places, but it's more fun the other way. Anyway, this is a study that has just been completed by my graduate student, Kala Laxminarayanan. She just got her PhD a couple of weeks ago. And what she looked at was going back to that same old boring Talal repetition test, but with senior citizens this time. Beep, beep, press the button, right? And what's really amazing, if you go up from two tones to three tones to four tones to five tones, and you have to remember them. So these are like beep, 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 and this might be beep, 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 and this would be beep, 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 beep. And the only thing that's different between here and here is the interstimulus interval. Here, the interstimulus interval was 500 milliseconds, and here it was between 0 and 150 milliseconds. And look at the huge difference. These are for normal, healthy senior citizens who have no sign of dementia or anything else. And what we see is that up to five tones, there's no significant difference in memory for senior citizens, despite everyone complaining about it. What's really different is how fast you can process. At just these lower ISIs, even at two tones, there's a highly significant difference between senior citizens and college students. These are college students, these are the elderly, okay? Okay.
Paula, well, it's not so much that we don't remember so much. I remember a lot of things, just none of them are true.
Yeah. True, that's good. 1 millionth child just completed Fast Forward training programs in over 4,500 schools in the United States, and now 33 countries internationally have received Fast Forward language and our reading intervention programs. So we're in the business of translating basic research into classrooms and clinics. What we've learned along the way is that it's really, really hard work. The part beyond the good idea, the part beyond the good science, beyond the publications, is much, much harder than most of us ever dreamed it would be. Because getting these diversity of students in diversity of schools to stick to a protocol, which is what it really takes to drive brain plasticity, is pretty difficult. And so the precision of implementation becomes your main challenge when you go forward. So that will be important for us here in the center to understand that, that it's the implementation that really requires a whole science in and of itself in terms of understanding what the steps are and how to get there most effectively and efficiently, especially cost efficiently for the schools. So thank you very much for your attention, and you've been a great class.